The following recording is a production of Critical Studies in Media Communication, a publication of the National Communication Association and distributed by Taylor and Francis under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. For more information about this audio recording and Critical Studies in Media Communication, please visit Taylor and Francis at www.tandfonline.com. For this installment of the podcast, and a few others, we're trying something a little bit different. We've asked the reviewer to end their review with a few questions for the book's author. Once the review was accepted for publication, we then contacted the author and solicited responses to those questions.
Imagining the Global, Transnational Media and Popular Culture Beyond East and West, by Fabian Darling Wolfe, published by University of Michigan Press in 2015. Review and audio recording by Lindsay Decker, graduate student, Syracuse University. Fabian Darling Wolfe's Imagining the Global, Transnational Media and Popular Culture Beyond East and West argues that an understanding of the relationships between the local, national, and global must be flexible enough to take into account the dynamic and nuanced ways in which these sites are both shifting and mutually constitutive. The book is an ambitious project for a number of reasons. Unlike many transnational studies, which examine transnational influences within one specific national site, Darling Wolfe takes on the flows between three different national sites: Japan, France, and the United States. This requires, on Darling Wolfe's part, an understanding of three very different languages and cultures. Imagining the Global also spans a variety of media, including reality television programs, newspapers, fashion magazines, hip-hop music, anime and cartoons, and comics and manga. This multimedia approach necessitates the fusion of several methodologies, including textual and rhetorical analysis, as well as some media industry studies work. In addition to this, for several chapters, Darling Wolfe incorporates data and quotations from interviews she conducted with populations within her three sites of investigation, representing several years of field work. The complexity and layers of the work cannot truly be captured in a single review. Darling Wolfe situates her work within a number of scholarly conversations, including transnational media scholarship and hip-hop studies. Theoretically, her work is most conversant with that of cultural anthropologist Arjun Abadurai, particularly his work on globalization. Building throughout the book, Darling Wolfe's theoretical project is simultaneously a call for increased nuance in transnational media scholarship and a questioning of the way that work on the East-West binary is too often marked by the tendency to reify the West as a culturally homogeneous notion. In particular, Darling Wolfe calls to task scholars who use the term the West to somewhat unself-reflexively indicate the U.S. or the U.K. rather than using those more appropriate, specific appellations. She constructs this argument through a series of case studies examining the way that the interactions between media and consumers in Japan, France, and the United States are consistently more complex than scholarship has generally allowed. Each of the case studies in Imagining the Global take up a particular media product to investigate its relationship to the local, national, and global. In her first chapter, Darling Wolfe examines the French reality television show Star Academy. She argues that, on the local level, it functions as an aspirational program that features people of different backgrounds working and living together in order to foster an attitude of, if not acceptance, tolerance. At the same time, on the global level, the show works to present an idealized France to its own imagined global audience. To do so, it glosses over the very real and deeply tense racial and urban divides within the country. Darling Wolf points out that adaptations of the program in other countries reflect very different national contexts, as well as differently imagined global audiences. Chapter 2 turns to an examination of transnational news coverage of national crises, including 2005's Hurricane Katrina, civil unrest in France the same year, and the 2011 Japanese earthquake. Darling Wolf shows, through a textual and rhetorical analysis of major national newspapers in Japan, France, and the U.S., that each press tended to use tragedies and unrest elsewhere to downplay their own national crises. However, she found that the French and U.S. presses interpreted and framed Japanese reactions to the earthquake and tsunami as a function of innate cultural and racial traits. Both chapters 1 and 2, though in different ways, show the highly complex interactions between media across sites and resist overstated conclusions, reinforcing Darling Wolf's call for more nuance in debates about transnational media scholarship. In her third and fourth chapters, Darling Wolf focuses on fashion magazines and hip-hop music in order to examine a variety of interconnected themes: race, gender, the national, the global, and both Western and American influence. In her chapter on fashion magazines, she draws on her fieldwork that focused on the relationship between Japanese women and Japanese fashion magazines. Particularly compelling is the section where Darling Wolf discusses how these women respond to the dominance of white models and Western styles in their magazines. She refrains from the common move of positioning these women as either victims of Westernization or as cultural dupes. Instead, she presents their complex reactions in relation to the ways in which these magazines construct the global, and how these women position their own identities in relation. Chapter 4 concentrates on Japanese and French hip-hop, particularly their differing sense of influences and their reception within their own national context and abroad. As she states, the global spread of hip-hop has, quote, rendered its politics of representation exponentially more complex, unquote, than has generally been taken into account. In highlighting the different economic and racial politics of Japanese and French hip-hop, Darling Wolf effectively critiques both the perspectives that place the U.S. at the center of global culture and academia's heavy focus on American hip-hop. Darling Wolf's final case study takes up popular anime and manga titles, tracing their cultural resonance within Japan and France. Bringing in her fieldwork again, she discusses the ways in which these Japanese-produced texts shape the childhoods and cultural identities of people in both Japan and France. She notes that in general, people from the United States tend to have cultural identities shaped primarily by U.S. media. Conversely, people in Japan and France have more of a transnational cultural background and are more comfortable and familiar with media produced outside of their own nation. These conclusions feed directly into the following chapter, which illustrates the ways in which our experience of the global is shaped more by our experience of global media than it is by our experience of other peoples. U.S.-produced content has long dominated global screens, influencing conceptualizations of the global and national cultural identity. However, as Darling Wolf argues, it has also led to a very different global imaginary for U.S. consumers as compared to those from other places in the world. This leads Darling Wolf to conclude that we as scholars must take care not to draw far-reaching conclusions when theorizing the global through a U.S. context. In her final chapter, she steps back from her case studies and the, quote, hybrid nature of global culture, unquote, she finds therein, to advocate for a continuing consideration of what she calls glocamalgamation. By glocamalgamation, she means the very sort of nuanced exploration of radical hybridity that she has undertaken in the book. It is a conceptualization of the global that takes into account its status as a construct whose relationship to the national and local is continually in flux. Through her own methodological hybridity, Darling Wolf pushes herself and other communications scholars to work not simply from the center or periphery. Rather, she advocates locating entry points in ways that destabilize the boundaries of identity and culture that work to confine scholarly work to traditional conceptualizations of the national and the global. Imagining the global could be useful to a variety of audiences, though it is perhaps more of a scholar's book than a text to be used piecemeal for undergraduate study. The book could be of interest to media scholars interested in Japanese, French, or U.S. media, as well as scholars interested in the global or transnational. The media-specific chapters could be particularly interesting to scholars working primarily within the particular media covered therein. However, because the book's argument builds steadily with each chapter, dipping in for a single chapter may be less effective than reading, perhaps, the introduction, the chosen chapter, and final chapter, or just reading the entire book. Darling Wolf's work is, on the whole, both interesting and an important addition to scholarship on transnational media. I do have to temper my praise with two potential criticisms. First, Darling Wolf introduces an innovative term in her second-to-last chapter, glocamalgamation. This intervention could have perhaps made a stronger impact if it had been incorporated from the start of the book and made explicitly central to the book's argument rather than implicitly so. Given the emphasis on nuanced terminology throughout the rest of the study, the late edition leaves the reader to wonder in what situations Darling Wolf would recommend glocamalgamation be used, or if the book is meant to build a case for the necessity of the term. Second, some of Darling Wolf's medium-specific case studies and arguments leave this reader wanting more. Several of her case studies, such as her examination of hip-hop, could easily be spun into books of their own. This illustrates one challenge of carrying out cross-cultural fieldwork. The reader would perhaps benefit from a more detailed explication of Darling Wolf's methodological insights on how to navigate, manage, and approach the various challenges, language and otherwise, scholars face when carrying out the nuanced work she advocates.
About block amalgamation appearing only in the second to last chapter, that's actually something that the reviewers pointed out early on, but that I decided not to change, and for several reasons. First, the fact that the term only comes toward the end parallels my thinking process in writing the book. My starting point was trying to figure out what was going on in those globalized cultural forms and their receptions, and then figure out how scholars can better conceptualize them. Because I was really most interested in engaging with the complexity of the global, national, local nexus, it seemed to me artificial to impose a framework from the start. So yes, while the book ultimately is very much meant to build a case for the necessity of the term, I decided it would be more effective to present the emergence of the concept in a more processual and organic way. Second, it felt a little arrogant to start by coining a term and then spend a whole book showing why it's useful. So I chose to kind of toss it at the end and let people decide what they want to do with it. Of course, I think they should keep it in mind when studying all kinds of media forms and the reception, but that's up to them. Similarly, as far as putting more of the method into the book, I would have loved to be able to have an arriving in the field chapter like you find in the classic ethnographies, but I wanted the book to be more about the text and the people who consume them than about me. Regarding the second comment, I completely agree that any of those chapters could turn into an entire book, and in fact, I have plans for a book on Japanese animation in France that was inspired by the animation chapter. In regards to methodology, I have written more extensively about translocal ethnography elsewhere, and I'm planning to continue to do so. It should be noted, however, that it's not that unusual for people to have to negotiate multiple cultural contexts and multiple languages. My two daughters, for instance, went to a French immersion school in Philadelphia, and they were certainly not the only ones there to have three passports. A good number of the kids were both tricultural and trilingual. Unfortunately, the U.S. educational system is not exactly pushing language acquisition. We actually used to have a language requirement in our PhD program at Temple, but it was dropped. I think exposure to other languages, even if one does not fully master them, is so important because it opens the door to learning about other cultures. Also, right now, in media studies and communication, there's so much emphasis on social media, virtual interactions, that the physical lived experiences of individuals are receiving relatively less attention. And of course, virtual interactions are relatively easier to access. Indeed, from a methodological point of view, there are certainly challenges associated with doing this kind of work. I would say that overall, the biggest challenge is probably time, especially when working in the field of media and communication, where we don't have a long tradition of going away for years at a time to do field work like you might have in an anthropology program. It simply takes a while to develop the kind of access needed to be able to do this well. Beyond access, you also need time to really educate yourself about the cultural context you're studying. Once you do have access, the logistics of having to stay connected with multiple field sites can also be taxing. Language, of course, is an issue. Japanese is a constant struggle for me, and there aren't a lot of opportunities to practice, so I basically have to constantly reteach myself. Overall, I think you have to be pretty dedicated to do this kind of work, and in all honesty, it might not be the best career move, but I believe the size of the reward matches the extent of the struggle. What I think is most valuable about multi-sided work is that it really brings epistemological questions to the forefront. When I first embarked in fieldwork as a grad student, I spent a lot of time thinking about my position as a white Westerner conducting research with Japanese women. And this was at the time of the so-called crisis of representation in anthropology, so there were lots of discussions of issues of positionality and quite a bit of anxiety about the politics of representation. I was very aware of my position as an outsider in Japan in my early fieldwork and reflexive about it. But it wasn't until I started doing research in France that my understanding of these issues came full circle. On one hand, not having to deal with the language barrier and having grown up in the region made access so much easier. On the other hand, I had to resist the tendency to claim my insider status and work harder to identify the points at which I was making assumptions based on my experience of being born and raised there. It was also interesting to experience how differently my work on the French context was received. I often felt that I was given automatic epistemic authority in the U.S. academic context simply because I'm a native speaker and have a French passport. This was a bit strange to me, as in many respects, I feel that I know more about Japanese history and culture from having spent so many more years studying it. So being positioned differently in different contexts helped you get over the insider-outsider, emic-etic dichotomy to really think about your position on a continuum. In many ways, doing research in France and the US helped me relax about my position in Japan. I'm a different kind of insider-outsider in each place. And I think having multiple frames of reference from which to draw is really useful.